You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking with Nelson Kinnersley about knowledge sharing and what it means for you. Nelson is a really, really nice statistician and a really knowledgeable statistician. He shares lots of his knowledge in articles on LinkedIn and on his website. So go to the references and then click through to his LinkedIn page and also to his consulting company where he publishes all this nice content. You'll learn a lot about the industry and how to develop new therapies in a very, very smart way. Today we are talking about knowledge sharing, and that is quite close to my heart, of course, because that's what I'm doing here all the time. So keep on listening, and what it means to you, we'll have a lot of discussion. And that is actually important for you, irrespective where you work. We'll go into this as well, and also discuss a little bit what the future will bring. Is peer publishing dead? Listen to what we are talking about. As we are talking about talking, please talk to your colleagues about this podcast and help them also to benefit from it. The wider we spread the word, the better. And if you love this podcast, others might love it as well. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is only £20 for non-high income countries and only £95 for high-income countries. So head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. There's a lot of material coming up in these different webinars, so for around the world next year. So stay tuned for that. Welcome to another podcast episode of the Effective Statistician. This time it's again with Benjamin, and we have a guest today, Nelson. Hi, Benjamin. First of all, long time since we talked, so great to catch up again on the podcast here.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I'm really looking forward for today because we have a very special guest, Nelson. And Nelson Kinnersley, who is probably quite known to some of you guys. And Nelson, can we make it start with you and just introduce yourself so we know who you are and what you're doing and maybe why you're here?
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Benjamin, and also Alexander for that introduction. And there are probably a number of people that I've met over the years that might be familiar, but I'm sure there are many, many more working in the industry and listening to this that haven't come across me. So, and actually, yeah, just reflecting or a little bit preparing for this, I was wondering, when was it that I first learned about statistics or heard about it? And I actually did an A-level. So, you know, those outside the UK, that's the exams you take when you're 18. And I did statistics there and, you know, learned that you could actually get jobs in statistics. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I thought, well, when I went to university, I wanted to do a bit more statistics. So I did a maths degree that had about 50% statistics content in there. And medical statistics was one of the final year options. And that was taught by Richard Kay, who used to be at the University of Sheffield. And I think many people know Richard Kay as a consultant and, you know, courses and various other activities. So he's certainly been, there on my journey with statistics. After my bachelor's, I went and got a master's in medical stats and really, you know, loved that. But I didn't know exactly what kind of job. So I actually went back and spoke to Richard, who was still at the University of Sheffield at the time. And he And he said, yep, you can get jobs in this. And in fact, I'm setting up a new CRO. I'm leaving the university and setting that up. So this was back in 1990. And I managed to secure a job. I was employee number 7. I remember that. And it was a specialist statistics and data management CRO. And since being bought by PyrExcel. So that was, if you like, you know, going from education into my first job. Had a fantastic time there at S-Cubed as it was. And then I realized that what I wanted to do next was move into industry. Having worked for many different clients, as I know, you know, people do in CROs, notwithstanding they'll have, you know, changed since I was there. I knew that the next step was in industry and, you know, trying to understand a little bit more in depth. So I moved to Sanofi and joined their UK group there and got increasingly involved with some of the projects, drug development, management. And the next step after that was actually going independent. And I was a consultant for 4 years. I mean, I think it was roughly 4 years. Before then moving to Roche in the year 2000. And I think that's where I've certainly spent the bulk of my career at Roche in various roles, you know, project statistician, individual contributor, manager, and doing various other things along the way. But that's a fairly long introduction, and I'm sure we can, if necessary, touch on some of those points over, but maybe just gives the audience a little bit of a flavor for, you know, how I got to where I am today as an independent consultant.
Yeah. And today we have actually a very, very interesting topic to speak about, and that is knowledge sharing. Knowledge sharing about statistics, about what we all do, about our business acumen, and basically, you know, helping each other through a pretty big community to overall increase the knowledge of our community, to help each other, to cross boundaries. And so, yeah, it perfectly fits with this podcast, because this is one of these platforms where we can use to share knowledge and bring people together. Let's get a little bit off into this. Nelson, from your point of view, what do the industry organizations, so Roche and other companies, play a role in knowledge sharing?
Yeah. Thanks, Alexander. And I do find the topic of knowledge sharing, you know, fascinating. I think, you know, I've certainly listened to many of the podcasts that you and Benjamin have put together, and the idea of continually learning is, you know, comes up as a theme with a number of your episodes and other speakers being curious. And I think that's something which I always have strived to do is, you know, keep learning, but also in various roles that I've been in, you know, that's one of the responsibilities, you know, whether it's as a manager talking with individuals that might report into you, or it's working on teams and, you know, maybe someone's learned something on the team and, you know, how do you learn from them? How can you convey that? So I think this is a very, very close to my heart, this topic of knowledge sharing. So specifically, you're asking about, you know, industry organizations and, mm-hmm. you know, particular, you know, the one that I think most of us are most close to, PSI, and, you know, other ones affiliated with FSPI, et cetera. And I think, you know, some of the bigger organizations arguably have a bigger potential to offer these. So, you know, maybe a department of 40 or 50 statisticians, amongst that, you know, 5%, 10%, it can make quite an impact for an organization like PSI. Maybe that's working on SIGs, so these special interest groups. Maybe it's leading some of these, perhaps some of the scientific committees and other things like that. And certainly I wouldn't like to say that, you know, the bigger organizations should necessarily dominate, but they should certainly have an opportunity to have their fair share. Many of them, of course, have larger premises and, you know, meeting rooms and facilities that can then host some of these events. So it could be, you know, sessions for the intro to industry that PSI runs, or maybe it's, you know, particular days. So I think that's somewhere where, you know, big pharma and the larger organizations can play their role. So that's at least just one or two comments, but I'm, you know, interested to hear your own views. You know, you work for two different organizations. What's your views on what big pharma can do in that?
Yeah, actually, in terms of the ITIT course that you just mentioned, we have an episode on that as well. So if you're just listening to this and wonder what that is, you know, after this episode, just scroll back in your podcast player and find this episode as well, especially for people that are earlier in their career, a very, very helpful program. But going back to the question in terms of the different organizations, I think it's these across company organizations, like we have in Europe with FSPI, PSI, like in the US with the ASA, like lots of different parts of the world, so it's biometrical organizations. These are really platforms where we can help each other to grow, both from a technical point of view, so learning about better ways to analyze our data, drive forward these innovations, but also where we can learn about how we can, you know, more effectively work. What are, you know, better processes? What are better personal behaviors in terms of working together? And so these organizations offer a lot of opportunities there to learn. But of course, they completely depend on the time that people spend in it. And most of it is volunteering time. But I think, you know, the companies that basically do make this possible by giving their people the time to work on this and that pay the salaries of these volunteers, they get also a lot back, because whenever there's someone speaking from any company and at any of these events or is helping there, that gives visibility to these organizations. And visibility in these parts, I think, is really important for making sure that you can attract talent, that you can, you know, fill open positions with the right people. And if you're well known as a organization in these parts, then people will see, yeah, I like the people that work there. I've seen them speaking here and there, and that looks like a great organization to work for. And it's something completely different when you, you know, then have an organization and you look into who's actually part of that. I've never heard about that. So from my own point of view, I would always try to, you know, move into a company where there's people that are active on these organizations, rather than into an organization where I have never heard about.
Especially if you require or desire this type of involvement yourself, so then you know that the companies are supporting this. Yeah, and maybe, I mean, just going back also when you since you mentioned the previous podcast, I think we already touched this that. The environment that we as a statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry and also in the CRO side, they're growing up, it's unique. It's unique in a way that we do have these organizations and that the sharing is so open. So we really learn from our competitors in stats. That's not about the, you know, the the product itself, but in stats. So we have a lessons learned, basically, because somebody already did it and did it wrong or did a mistake, and we learn from other people's mistakes. So we help each other in a unique way, which I'm not sure. I mean, you know, given the history that we all have, I don't know if this is really existing in other areas, but it's really amazing and impressing for us as statisticians to have the opportunity to learn and to share the knowledge as we currently do.
Yeah,
I would agree with both those, and I you know, certainly very much impressed by what I hear and see, and also attend, you know, be it a webinar, be it, you know, some of special interest groups, etc., that, you know, PSI, ASA put on. But I think also maybe a bit of a call out for DIA, you know, the Drug Information Association. Many people will be familiar, but, you know, in case there are some that aren't, I can remember going to my first DIA conference, and you know, they put them on in the US, but you know, Europe and elsewhere, and I found that to be such an enriching, rewarding experience going to one of those, particularly early on in my career, because not only do you get exposed to these statistical tracks that, you know, maybe you're more interested in, arguably, but there are so many other tracks that are going on, and you know, you can dip in. Maybe there's nothing, you know, particularly on the statistics track, you want to go to at 11 in the morning. So you just walk along and, you know, you might go into a clinical one, or you might go into a quality one, or a manufacturing or a commercial one, or something like that. And I'm not necessarily advocating that, you know, people go to one of those conferences every year or something. But for those who haven't been to something like that, where it's cross-functional, maybe take a look at one of those programs and see whether that's something that could, you know, help you learn, but also maybe you want to present at and then have a slightly more diverse audience.
Yeah, very good. And that's also a great opportunity to improve your presentation skills.
Yeah, we can all do that.
So in terms of tools, platforms, what do you think is, you know, from your point of view as outset, that has helped you most to gain knowledge, but also share your knowledge?
Yeah. So I think, you know, clearly the most obvious are the journals. You know, that's something where, you know, cutting edge, new, peer-reviewed information is going to be, you know, initially put out there. But I think increasingly what I'm attracted towards is what's happening around in some of the social media platforms. And I think in particular, looking at something like Twitter, something like LinkedIn, for actually almost the next level on from a journal article. You know, a journal articles are brilliant for outlining, you know, what's a problem, how do we tackle it, what's the innovation, maybe there's an application, often there's an application in there as well, wonderful. But I think there's then something on from that, which is, how do you use this information? What's the consensus on this methodology? And I think if one only confines oneself to a journal and then maybe a response to a journal or a retraction or something like that, then you're missing out. And what I found is, and you know, we're in a recording this at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic, and you know, there's a lot of debate that's going on. You know, and lurk or, you know, observe some of the debates in Twitter, which are talking about some of the vaccine trials, which are talking about some of the treatment trials, you know, some really eminent statisticians who are contributing to that. And I find that to be, you know, very rewarding, because, you know, I may have my own views on something, or I may have seen something reported, but when one sees that that kind of, you know, rich debate is going on, I find that that's something that I'd like to pay some attention to. I also mentioned the LinkedIn platform, and, you know, it's, I'm still wrestling and getting to grips with what that looks like, and, you know, what good looks like, and how best to. So I'm, you know, eager to hear your insights and how best to use that. But there's another platform that I think is slightly different from what Twitter could offer. It is different from what a journal platform offers. And is it going to wither and die on the vine? I'm not sure, because, you know, heavy investment from Microsoft in the LinkedIn platform, it probably isn't going to wither. But have we got the best out of it yet? I don't know. You know, do you have particular views yourselves on the use of these platforms?
So in terms of journals, you know, my frustration about journals was one of the reasons why I started the podcast. Because, you know, it takes forever to publish an article. And then there is a, you know, very often this is you get a lot of comments from the reviewers, which of course is a great thing, but it's always kind of, you know, still having your own voice in there, and you want to maybe publish something that is not completely kind of, you know, streamlined and things like that, and you want to have a debate, and you want to have more kind of opinion things and things like that. And they are, I think, kind of the usual way of peer review journals is neither fast, yeah, not easy. And so I think there's where, for example, here's a podcast or Twitter or LinkedIn comes in, because it is fast and easy, and you can have an opinion and you can debate in very much like real time, rather than, you know, write a paper, get it submitted, get it accepted, which maybe takes 1.5 years, and then you get, you know, responses, and then another responses, which take a couple of months, you know, especially when you think about COVID-19, that's happening so rapidly. Yeah. And lots of what we are doing is you want an answer now, not in 2 years. Yeah. So, this is where I think these other platforms can play a big role.
Yeah, especially as you do, you know, do link in existing platforms. So it's not a full competition in terms of, you know, replacing publication platforms or anything. It is, you know, you can also make use of the publication platforms and link it into your profile and to the discussion, to really, you know, cross-share or cross-link different sources and everything on these platforms. So I think this is an extremely important and vivid way of driving things along in terms of knowledge sharing and also in terms of the discussions, no? as you mentioned.
Yeah, a couple of comments. I certainly would agree that there is going to be continue to be a place for peer-reviewed strong journals that, you know, that reflect a deep amount of work. You know, if somebody wants to, you know, spend months for good reason on some simulations or some theory, yes, that is ultimately going to be able to help us, and we can rely on that when we're putting into practice. I think one of the things that we could do a better job is closing the gap between theory and practice. And I think arguably many of the journals, and particularly pre, you know, COVID, have been very much based in the old ways, the kind of paper, you know, a journal gets, you know, published, and people read a table of contents, they decide which abstracts that they want to read, and then of those, which are they going to do? And then they might pass it to a friend or a colleague, oh, why don't you read this, and da-da. And then somebody decides, oh, maybe we could implement this in our team, and maybe it gets knocked back, and then you know, someone shows leadership, and it's put, and before we know, it's many years between theory and practice. And maybe this is a little bit of a challenge to some of those journals that, you know, why let the Twitters and the LinkedIn and other platforms be the only place that debate happens? You know, if some of these journal websites open themselves up to more real-time debate and they've got the publications, they're right there, and they can have that debate in their platform, why wouldn't we also use that? I'm not saying everybody would use it, and then, you know, the absence of those. But I think that there may be something that some of these journal platforms could really think about doing, is helping to close the gap between theory and practice and use that communal debate, this consensus, in a faster way to do that. So anyway, that's just something that I've been, you know, pondering over. I have no way currently to influence any of the big journals to do that, but if some of the listeners do, maybe they'd like to take it on.
Yeah, I think the difference is also that the platforms are usually like LinkedIn. These platforms have a brighter range of listeners, well, readers. So basically, usually the publication platforms are more focusing on a very, you know, tiny specific part of the readers, like statisticians, while in LinkedIn you get crossover, you know, programming or other areas which is connected to it. It might be interested, even if it's completely different, you know, psychologists or, you know, people that are interested in a specific topic. So that might be an advantage, at least for LinkedIn or and these platforms, because this is more open and easier to access already to a wider branch.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, also in these, it's very transparent and open. Yeah, and real people talk to real people. And there is not kind of, you know, anonymous, you know, big organizations or journals. It's, you know, there's Nelson talking to Benjamin and Alexander, and not, you know, Wiley talking to someone. And so I think people appreciate that. Yeah, and then you can have a real debate about things, and it's okay to have, you know, to come up with an opinion and then, you know, revise it and share ideas and share tips. I think also in terms of, you know, tips and tricks, it's impossible to publish, you know, little tips. Whereas, you know, on LinkedIn, it takes you 5 minutes to share that with the world and to let your friends and your community know about, hi, there's a cool new feature of R. Have you seen it? Have you applied it yet? And, or there's, you know, or ask a question, you know, I struggle to get this implemented. Anybody that can help me? These type of things are not possible in journals, and I think this is where kind of it, these platforms help us to realize the theory, and it's really fast and easy.
Yeah, and to bring it back to, you know, one of the things that's, you know, part of this podcast theme about how that may be different in big organizations versus the smaller ones, you know, those people who are or have been part of big ones will know that just by sheer numbers, you can, you know, turn to somebody. Now, whether that's virtually turning to somebody in these days where there's a lot of remote working, or it's actually turning to somebody. But, you know, you have that trust, or you can ask that silly question, or you can put an intranet posting out with anyone, help me with that. I think for those people who are maybe part of smaller organizations, or they're smaller departments within big organizations, maybe some of these external platforms are one of the only vehicles or one of the few vehicles where they do get those tips and tricks. So I think that, you know, that could be one of those differences between the big and the small, is the greater use of some of those external platforms by people who may be in the smaller departments and smaller organizations.
Yeah, sure. If you're working in an organization that has, don't know, 500 statisticians and has a special group with advanced knowledge statisticians, well, there's always someone that, you know, is really good in a specific area. But even, you know, with all the statistics part becoming faster and faster in terms of new developments, with all the data science or the computer technology becoming available, I think at a certain point, even these big organizations will struggle to have an expert on everything. And also, you know, it becomes a problem of communication and connection in these big organizations as well. It's, you know, if you're working in a big organization, you know, you don't know everybody anymore. Yeah, so there's the connection and the relationships might even be easier for people that you have outside of the company. So I think there's, you know, there's probably both sides. And then, of course, there's the kind of, you know, if you post a question internally, people may ask, well, shouldn't you know that? Or, you know, or maybe you have the feeling that people would ask this question, or maybe you feel bad about, you know, this and then. That depends, of course, on the company culture. If, you know, people are encouraged to share questions, and or is it a company culture where you are expected to be a know-it-all? Yeah, so That's also another topic.
Yeah, I recognize that one. That one could be a conversation for another day, culture. And I know you've spoken quite a bit about it on some of your previous podcasts.
Yeah.
I mean, we touched the topic about the the knowledge sharing, and that is where I wonder. You said that you moved from Roche to your own consultancy. So what is your first, maybe let's start with has there been anything surprising in setting up your own business? I mean, must be different. I mean, you had it before, long time ago. But is it different now? Yeah. And also I would like to know, so what is your focus? And because, if we talk about knowledge sharing, that seems to be a little bit contradictory in being a consultant, because, obviously everything is available. So why do we need a consultant then?
Yeah, excellent. I like your challenging questions, Benjamin. Thank you. Yeah. So there were a couple of things that you kind of, mention in there. And, I think one of the things that's, recognizable about a big organization is that they can draw on many, many more resources often, whether it's a full wide access to every journal that's, forever there, that they pay a subscription and every employee can get access to it, or they maybe have a bigger training budget than some of the other organizations, or people who do go on those conferences that may not be yourself come back and do a conference trip or a report, things like that. So I certainly think there is a potential for more access to information and knowledge, in a large organization. But I think, and this is, to me, this is not a grass is always greener on one side than the other. I think, there are just different things that one can do. So, in a smaller organization or as an individual, at a consultancy, there really is so much out there on the internet or social media or, other kind of platforms where you can do it. But sometimes it's behind paywalls. And I think, one of the things that we've seen in 2020 through trying to pursue knowledge about the coronavirus and COVID-19 disease is some of those larger organizations have opened up areas that previously would have been behind firewalls. So to me, that, raises the question, how much will people be willing to pay for subscription-based content in the future, and what's the price that they're willing to pay for that, and what will the added value be given that some of this release behind that paywall? I don't have any magic answers, but I think it does raise the question, and people will be increasingly asked about that. We see many more open platforms for people publishing and in putting copies of their work in open platforms. So I think that one could say that there were advantages in the former days by being in a large organization because you had all these subscriptions and all these reports. But in the future, I'm not sure that gap will be so large, and that people who can have access to the information in real time and discuss and debate that will allow that kind of more seamless transfer of knowledge, sharing of knowledge. So I think, we live in interesting times, and if you had this podcast in 2 years time, 3 years time, 4 years time, it'd be interesting to see how much of that has changed over there. So there's just a couple of thoughts about what that knowledge sharing aspect, the big versus small. And the other thing I want to say before I just pause is, it's very early days for me moving out of a big organization where I was at for 20 years, so please don't take this as some wonderful, meta-analysis and review of what it's like in every big pharma versus every small organization. So it's, it's early days. And I know you've had other podcasts, Oliver from Cogitas, who'd, made a similar move. So, let's just keep sharing. I don't believe that, there is always a good on one side of the fence and always bad on the other. I think there are trade-offs, but there's also, that's not static. And I think things are evolving with knowledge sharing and will continue to.
Yeah, completely agree. In terms of these sometimes actually quite expensive journals. I wonder whether, you know, one time someone sets up a blog or something like this where people can publish something, other people critique it, review it, and then, you know, you have a nice kind of transparent peer review process where in the end you have a final paper there. And something where, you know, you directly see, okay, who has peer reviewed it, what was the conclusions from the author on it, and what were the correction. I don't see, you know, why that wouldn't be, you know, as helpful as the current big peer review journals. I think one of the kind of questions around it is the prestige and things like that, this kind of impact factor topic, and you know, our whole kind of academic system is based on, you know, all of this. I think that is something that probably needs to be disrupted, but I completely agree, you know. We don't need paper prints anymore. Who reads paper prints, really? Yes, so of course there's still kind of big libraries of all these kind of things, but even when, you know, about 25 years ago when I was, you know, sitting in the library, I would rather, you know, download the PDF copy of it than try to find the respective journal somewhere in the library. So
maybe just to, you know, in the scenario you described of this kind of iterative work towards a final, let's call it publication, you know, it might be a paper, we can call it what we like, but that kind of iterative process, I think, firstly, I agree it's more attractive. I think it could arguably mean that more people get to do it because, you know, my perception of this is, and actually based on, you know, experience of talking and identifying barriers to publication is people, or some people feel they're not worthy of it. Some people feel that the effort to do it may not be worthwhile. Something may not get accepted. And that could mean that some valuable information or a valuable perspective is not being shared. And maybe a more iterative approach is more likely. Someone will get started, someone will get excellent feedback during that, and ultimately the work can get out there sooner, and, you know, the final consensus will be valuable for it. So I think the iterative ideas has got a number of appealing elements, but ultimately having something in an archive that we can all go and benefit from at the end of it would be wonderful. I won't get on my hobby horse about incentivizing idea of academic journals and things like that. But if you're interested, maybe in that we can ponder over that. But I think, yeah, the incentivization of the, you know, the status and kudos is something that I have a couple of views on.
Yeah, but you have started recently on LinkedIn a really interesting series. You have published a couple of different longer documents in terms of how to structure development, what are kind of the different topics there. And I think that is a really, really nice step into this direction. Yeah, to publish something on a journal, on a platform like LinkedIn, where people can then, you know, share it freely, give feedback to you, therefore kind of have a little bit of this iterative process. What's your experience with that?
Thank you for those kind words. It's early days, as you say. I, you know, at the time of recording, I think there's something like four or five articles out there. Perhaps by the time this goes live, there'll be a few more. But you know, my thinking behind starting to publish those short articles, you know, 4 or 5 pages, was, you know, a reflection of some of those early moves out of Big Pharma and working for myself, and thinking, you know, have I got something that I could share? And you know, if I get zero views and zero reactions, no, Nelson, you've got nothing to share. So, you know, stop writing. Fine, that's okay. But the initial feedback from some of those articles has been helping motivate me write one or two more of those articles. And, you know, I'm sorting out in my own mind what the kind of target audience is. But what I think it is to me is the team. And by the team, I mean a team developing a new drug. A number of for a number of reasons, very good reasons, we often focus on the individual. You know, what can I do to improve this? What can I do to improve that? Or what can an organization do in terms of its culture to do this, etc.? I think there's an area which I find fascinating is the team dynamics. You know, a team develops a molecule. It gets budget approval from senior management. But who's accountable for that team and helping that get better and better? Often it's the team leader. Great, super. And you've got the most experienced team leader. He or she will run a highly effective team. Brilliant. If everybody on that team has got, you know, years and years of experience, they'll be able to bring all that to bear and everything works. But I've seen teams that have struggled. I'm sure we've all seen some, you know, sometimes we've been members of those teams where we've been the weak link in that chain. And you know, part of what I try to do or have tried to do in my career is help people that I manage or peers help their teams. And it struck me that there maybe wasn't the kind of article or the kind of forum for discussing how do we improve drug development when we put the team at the center. Maybe there is, and I just haven't found it. But I thought, well, okay, well, just, you know, share your views, Nelson, and someone will tell you, well, you're repeating what's elsewhere. Fine, okay. Well, but the kind of feedback I have had from the early ones is that people have appreciated, you know, one perspective on that. And, you know, the first in the series of articles was about target product profiles. And, it, you know, to get feedback from people who are heads of pharmacology units, people who work in big pharma, small pharma, from statisticians and others that, you know, are encouraged and have learned something and want to share, super. And, you know, I've tried to continue that journey talking about clinical development planning, phase one trials. I've got some other articles in the work for other things like that, but very much an experiment with how can we help teams. Drug development is so expensive, such high risk, and it seems to me that helping teams be more effective and using LinkedIn is one possible vehicle.
Okay, very good. Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much for these publications there. I'm just calling them publications because you put something out there on public. So we have touched on a lot of different things in this discussion about how we can share knowledge. What are the platforms, the societies? What are the benefits for the individual as well as for the organizations? What is kind of maybe new and emerging, and what might maybe change in terms of, you know, the subscription-based journals that currently still dominate the market, and how that might actually look very, very different in the future. So I think as a listener, you really enjoyed this discussion. Nelson, any final thoughts on this topic?
Thank you very much for a very concise summary of what's been a really enjoyable conversation. Thanks to Benjamin and yourself for, you know, hosting this. And what I'm really interested in is feedback from the listeners. So whether they're responding to, you know, your effective statistician webpage, whether they go on some of these LinkedIn articles, whether they, you know, post on Twitter, is that feedback, you know, is there more we can do? Drug development is expensive. We try and share, and, you know, we have this fear of missing out sometimes with not knowing about the latest technique, but we can do that together by just helping each other, you know, get on social media, give some feedback. Maybe it's a one-to-one email and, you know, hey, I don't agree with this, or, you know, have you thought about that? Great. Let's just keep using our collective knowledge to help drug development.
That was an awesome final sentence. Thanks so much for being here, and we'll surely catch up at another time.
Right. Thanks, Nelson.
Thanks very much, guys.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com, where you find all the references and much, much more to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. And please remember to tell your colleagues about this podcast. Like always, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.